Okay, so let's start. So James asked me to talk about wave turbulence, and he actually asked me to talk a while ago. This is a sort of a second attempt at this. Last time turned out I was away, but people only realized that when they showed up for the talk. So I guess this is going to be pretty informal, and I'm just going to kind of really try to avoid going into those very big calculations which the papers on wave turbulence are kind of famous for. If anyone has looked at the reviews by Alan Newell in particular, who's my PhD advisor, so it's not that I don't know these calculations and spent my PhD doing them, but they're not very illuminating, I think, for a short talk. But how many people sort of know what wave turbulence is about anyway? And I know a few people are kind of experts, so maybe others not. So, I guess let me just start by saying, I mean, if Michael McIntyre was here, you know, he'd kind of start by saying, well, you know, he hates the idea of wave turbulence because waves and turbulence are really separate things and they just don't mix. And that's a sort of, in the sense that Michael means this, I actually agree with him. But my perspective on what really is meant by turbulence is more broad, perhaps, than someone who just works solely in the context of fluid dynamics and vortex turbulence. Let me just sort of start by just sort of trying to make it clear what I mean when I talk about turbulence. So, in particular, in the sort of key feature is not so much that there are vortices or vortex stretching or whatever, but rather that there's a system where you have, you know, many interacting degrees of freedom, which is being driven by sources and sinks of some sort of dynamically significant quantity. For that, in that sense, you can read some conserved quantity usually, and where these sources and sinks are widely separated in terms of scale. So we can draw this sort of canonical picture. So there's some quantity which we call energy. And I'm putting quotes here because, okay, so energy, because actually in the context of many of these systems, you know, the conserved quantity might not actually be a physical energy. You know, there may be other things, like, for example, that one can consider cascades of wave action, cascades of entropy, various things. But there's something which is going to be conserved by nonlinear interactions in some nonlinear field equation, and there are sources and sinks of this quantity. Say there's some forcing scale, Kf, and then some dissipation mechanism, in here, some scale Kd, and yeah, so basically stuff goes in here, it's going to come out here, and in between there's some range of scales over which essentially this quantity is just being transferred by nonlinear interactions between the degrees of freedom. So there's sort of conservative dynamics here. This thing. So there's, so there's nothing necessarily fluid about this, right? I mean, that's the Kolmogorov theory of hydrodynamic turbulence, one example, where this conservative transfer is being mediated by vortex-vortex interactions. But it could equally be some other nonlinear equation. And the kind of canonical example that we've been talking about a lot at this program, and which I'm kind of going to start with, is this Czarny-Asagawa-Mimer barotropic potential vorticity equation. And this guy, that sort of nicely synthesizes both the kind of more traditional vortex ideas of turbulence together with ideas of wave turbulence. That's this equation. Let's put, say, equal to zero here, but really, I don't, we usually would put zero, but here I'm going to say this is equal to, say, forcing, just dissipation. because all of this discussion is for non-isolated system. There's going to be, you know, some forcing, some dissipation. The forcing could be, you know, maybe you just put some big pile of energy in large scales at the beginning and allow it to relax, and therefore the large scale, you know, you don't necessarily have to be driving the thing constantly. And the point is, you know, if you would do this, that initially, if you're going to do some kind of problem with relaxation like that, you want the initial condition to be supported mostly at large scale, so that you're well separated from the dissipation, which is going to be at small scales, so that you again have this idea of a window of transparency, or what we would call in turbulence an inertial range.
Are you only going to consider downscale?
Today, yes. I mean, pretty much everything I'm going to say about kind of cascades and wave turbulence, I usually refer back to this picture, but there are many examples where the cascade is actually inverse, and the forcing would be at the small scales and dissipation at large scales.
Can you question back? Locality in K-space?
I'm hoping to get to that by the end. The locality is a property which is going to come out of the theory in the end. I mean, this is, in my view, the kind of, you know, the key result of wave turbulence theory, in the sense of weakly nonlinear wave turbulence theory, is a clear way of assessing the extent to which the cascade is actually local or not. Like, it's the kind of the big question which often we can't really handle in the case of strong turbulence. We make various assumptions about locality and so on that are typically very hard to prove. I would say that, you know, the real selling point of weakly nonlinear wave turbulence is that you can really make this question of cascade locality completely clear and really sort of answer it, basically. So for the time being, I mean, I'm not going to assume locality per se, but this is always kind of in the background, that much of what one would discuss in this context is already assuming a local cascade.
Is this picture only valid for quadratic nonlinearities, or can you say
no.
It's very general?
No, so this is, so I kind of put these things up here. I mean, I'm going to switch from this particular equation to a more sort of generic picture in a little while, but I wanted to just at least have one concrete example written up. And for most of the rest of the talk, I mean, if you're someone who doesn't particularly like, say, Rossby waves or this equation, think of your favorite nonlinear wave equation, you know, whatever type of waves you're particularly interested in. More or less, much of what I will say is going to be equally true for those. Maybe, you know, if you have something particularly pathological, maybe there are some counterexamples. But for the most part, if it's dispersive and it's nonlinear, then there will exist a formulation of this theory which can try to describe that system.
Why does it have to be dispersive?
So the reason why it needs to be dispersive is not actually that obvious at the outset. And it maybe won't be obvious in the route that I'm going to take today. But the main reason that it needs to be dispersive is so that so that it's possible for wave. So it's easier to think of what happens if they're not. So if they're not dispersive, then basically if two wave packets get into sync, then they stay together basically forever. And this means that it's not really possible over long times for such wave packets to interact weakly, because they'll always overlap. Whereas if we have dispersive waves, then two wave packets which come together will only interact for some period of time because they're going to disperse. So it's possible for them to have, for the interaction between them to stay weak. But this kind of comes in technically in the mathematics in a way that sort of, maybe, you know, some people might prefer to see it that way, but kind of physically that's how I was thinking about it.
Is it possible to define some function and to explain how this equation obtained from the first principles?
Yes, of course, but I'm not going to do it today. Yeah. So we've actually already had a couple of tutorials about the origin of this one, right? I mean, so I'm just putting it down as an example. So what is it? Well, basically here, I mean, you know, this is the equation for conservation of potential vorticity.
And so can I just follow up on my question? So in order to, like, if for a given system, in order to answer, you know, is weakly nonlinear wave turbulence applicable to this or not, Mm-hmm. Would I take into consideration that it's how dispersive it is, and or what would I base that on?
Well, I'm hoping to explain this to you now. What you're going to want to do is you're going to want to essentially ask the question whether it makes sense for you to well, let me answer it in two things. Firstly, just to point out, an equation like this, and like any of these other equations which we're going to look down, I mean, what makes it different from Navier-Stokes turbulence is that there's a linear term which can be large compared to the nonlinear term. So it's possible in principle that there is a weakly nonlinear limit of the system. Now, this is different from Navier-Stokes. So that's the first thing. Then the second thing, in terms of whether this weakly nonlinear limit is applicable to a particular system you're interested in studying, what you want to establish is whether there is a separation in timescales between the linear and dynamics and the sort of spectral transfer induced by the nonlinear terms. And what I was hoping to kind of get to today is to sort of maybe go through how you can try to, just in terms of dimensional analysis mostly, establish whether this is likely to be the case or not.
Okay, and I hope to not prevent you from doing that much further, but could this also be low Reynolds number, just a viscous term that...
No. Well, because that's not going to give you any waves, right?
Yeah,
so there's no... Right. Okay, so this is a sort of a canonical example. This is an example to start with, and I'm going to just, I put it up there for the purposes of having something concrete. If you prefer to think about water waves or capillary waves or something like this, that's fine too. So I've kind of already said this. I mean, we can then essentially non-dimensionalize this equation just by introducing some particular scales. So we'll write the stream function in terms of some amplitude. So introduce some characteristic scale L to non-dimensionalize X, T the same. I forgot this, so beta L, giving a time scale. And so you go through this, and then at the end, sort of gather together all of your non-dimensional parameters in the usual way, and you can build essentially same equation again. Now here there's some parameter which comes in front of the nonlinearity. So just write zero for now. The forcing and dissipation is always implied here. And this this dimensionless quantity M, in the case of this Charney-Asagawa-Mima equation, is basically the Rossby number. So essentially, if the rotation of the beta parameter gets strong, rotation dominated, then M is small, and you're entering into this weakly nonlinear regime. If you have some other nonlinear wave equation in mind, then you can do the same kind of rescaling, and you'll always get, something coming out in front here, some formal parameter at least, which allows you to treat the nonlinearity as being weak if it's small. So that's the kind of key physical difference between, say, a system like this, wave turbulence, and hydrodynamic turbulence, where there's no way to scale the equation to get such a smallness parameter coming in front of the vortex-vortex interaction term. And so in the case of these guys, and for this equation, so we typically go into almost all of the theory of wave turbulences in Fourier space for obvious reasons, because waves are most naturally written as Fourier harmonics. So if you do that, then we can just write this equation here. Fourier space is kind of simple. This notation, by the way, we'll use quite a bit for the delta functions just to make things a bit simpler. And I just define here, so just upper versus lower to keep track of signs. And so in this, so this is just taking the Fourier transform of this equation, and I guess I should keep my nonlinearity parameter out front. So omega k, in this case, minus kx, k squared plus f, and this nonlinear interaction coefficient . This is sort of very standard stuff, very straightforward. And the kind of point about this, I mean, why I kind of write this down is that what we would like to do, I mean, to kind of proceed with this sort of calculation, wave turbulence, if you read a lot of the literature, people will sort of first seek kind of Hamiltonian formulation of the problem and do quite a lot. I mean, this is particularly popular in Zakharov's school, where actually, rather, so in the actual analysis will be done in Hamiltonian variables. So, sort of the first section of many papers is sort of starting with the equation of motion and then showing that it can be put in Hamiltonian form, and then proceeding, treating the nonlinear part of the Hamiltonian as a perturbation and developing and so on. It's actually not, this can be very helpful, of course, but it's not really necessary for any particular application. What you really want in the end. Or you just really need to find the normal variables. So you can really do all of the calculations directly starting from the wave equation if you just write things in normal variables. The kind of Hamiltonian structure is, so if you can find one, is a sort of a helpful additional thing or a nice elegant way to do it, but it's not necessary. So quite a lot of the complication in the literature, which you'll find, is kind of to do with the fact that the kind of Hamiltonian description, that, you know, the Hamiltonian calculations are mixed in with the sort of essential wave turbulence calculations. And I think, particularly if you don't know this stuff, it's probably better to separate them. So normal variables, I mean, this just basically means variables in which the energy density in k space is omega k, ak, ak star. Right? So we want to find these guys. And so for the case of CHM, this equation, the right choice for normal variables, we just take AK to be equal to K squared plus F square root. And I guess because this guy has the possibility for negative frequencies and put absolute value there. Right. So typically, people often ask me, when they're reading the papers on the wave table, what are these A's? What are these AK's? If I'm thinking of surface elevations, are the A's surface elevations? Well, no, they're not. They're very closely related. So they're basically the normal variables for whatever problem you're going to look at. And so the calculation goes much, much smoother in terms of these variables just because they're naturally associated with the frequencies. So as we'll see, one of the main results of the wave turbulence theory is that in the weakly nonlinear limit, all of this spectral transfer becomes localized on resonant interactions. And so these resonant interactions are, of course, most naturally expressed in terms of the normal variables. So that's just why people write those variables. If you want to go ahead in the original primitive variables, you can, but you just end up with a mess.
There'd be sometimes a nonlinear relationship if you're doing some sort of mean field treatment or trying to go beyond a weak wave picture.
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by that. So you mean to some kind of effective theory or something, or like in some like Hartree-Fock or something like that?
Right.
Yes, I mean this can happen, but you would usually sort of really try. This would enter really at the level of the kind of equation that you're going to deal with here. You would have already made some modified nonlinearity, and this happens quite a bit. People who do say, applying this kind of thinking to Bose-Einstein condensation, for example, where what you actually want to work in the variables after you do the Bogoliubov transformation. So, but then you can take that into account by modifying the equation of motion and then work from there. You don't really, you probably could do it at this level too, but it's easier to just start with the, you know, the transformed equation and go.
I guess my real question is, I mean, this all looks like it's patterned after methods in quantum many body physics. And historically, did it evolve from that, from people who were working in that, or was it independently sort of?
I think my understanding of it is that the, like maybe that some of those of you who know Zakharov better might know the history of it more. My understanding is from reading the literature is that it kind of evolved fairly independently, but afterward, instead of after the event, the connections were more realized. And in particular, people nowadays recognize that these kinetic equations, for example, were sort of written down first in the 20s by people like Parles, doing essentially scattering, phonon scattering, and things like this. Okay, so that's sort of, again, I kind of haven't really gotten too far yet. I've already used a lot of time, but never mind. So the main thing, so the main point of interest then is what we want to understand is correlation functions of this field, AK. So, and of course, the most important one is the wave spectrum, which for a statistically homogeneous system, take this second order correlation function, k prime star, defines n of k. So this quantity here, just in terms of terminology, you'll often hear people talking about this guy, just the integral of this guy, n of k. So this is the wave action. And in certain systems, the wave action can actually be conserved. In particular, if someone was asking already, if you had to stick to a quadratic nonlinearity here, if you have systems with cubic nonlinearity, such as nonlinear Schrodinger equation, this wave action turns out to be conserved. So you can have, you know, instead of having the energy, you can have a cascade of wave action. So that's an example of what I mean, that, you know, the conserved quantity is not always the energy. So, okay, that's... So now at this point, I mean, let me just say that you can kind of apply this to whatever kind of wave equation you really want. And so I've kind of written down here just a schematic, how any schematic nonlinear wave equation is going to look like in Fourier space once you've written it in terms of these normal variables. There's going to be a linear term and then some nonlinear interaction, which, so here I've actually written in terms of an n-wave process. Here n is 2, but if we were doing something like nonlinear Schrodinger equation or gravity waves on the fluid interface, n would be 4. So we can have whatever you want. And then there are some physical examples where n is even higher still. For example, one-dimensional water waves turns out to be a 5-wave process. There's even putatively some 6-wave process relevant to waves propagating on an oscillations on a quantum vortex. And some work on this recently. So where the elementary interactions involve 6 waves. So for kind of simplicity today, I want to sort of restrict the discussion now to isotropic systems. Stas is going to talk on Thursday, actually, about anisotropic systems.
So when you say 6-wave process, that means a process where there are no 2- to 5-wave interactions.
Well, actually, I don't know. There are no 2 to 5, but there might be 2 to 4. 2 to 5 gives 7 waves.
No, sorry, that's not what I mean. But, I mean, you only always take the lowest number of wave interactions into account.
Yeah. Right?
Presumably. Because otherwise, every other process is going to be higher order by assumption of this dimensionless parameter being small.
You take into account the lowest order one. I mean, sometimes it can be a little bit not entirely obvious. I mean, this is one of the ways where the Hamiltonian formalism can help you, because it can sometimes happen that depending on how you write the equation, it may look like there are lower order interactions, but none of them end up being resonant, so you can actually transform them away. And this is something which starts to become much more evident if you do have the technology of a Hamiltonian formalism. But you'll spot it here, too. I mean, if you would just go ahead blindly with from the equation of motion, if this is true, you'll just find that the interaction coefficients vanish for, say, quadratic interactions, and so then you'll know you need to go to higher order. But these are kind of things, these are subtleties which I'd rather not get into today. So people worry about them, and it's well known how to deal with them.
Well, how do you see that one-dimensional gravity wave for n equals 5?
Oh, this is exactly an example like this. You know, you say, oh, it should be four wave. You go ahead and you do the calculation, as I'm saying, you turn the crank, and you get some enormous mess for analog of this quantity, which when you plug into Mathematica turns out to be zero. So Zakharov, for example, I mean, when he found this, I mean, Zakharov, it's a quadratic nonlinearity on the face of things. You find that the three-wave interactions are easy. It's easy to see that you can make them go away. The four-wave ones go away in a non-obvious sense. I mean, you have to really calculate, you find they go away. And so I think Zakharov really believed that this was indicating that the one-dimensional water wave problem is integrable. But actually all, you know, if you go now look for fifth-order resonances, they'll also vanish. But the consensus now seems to be that actually the five-wave interaction coefficient is not zero. So, and then this was a really hairy calculation.
All these determinations are always subtle like this? Or there's no easy way to see that it's equals five?
I've stayed clear of this stuff, but as far as I know, there's no easy way to see other than coming up with some, something like inverse scattering, where you prove that the system's integrable, and then you know actually that all these things will vanish. But if you don't have such a proof to hand, then I don't think there's an obvious way of seeing it. All right, so I'm going to stick with isotropic systems today. Just for the sake of keeping things easy. Stas will talk about some anisotropic examples on Thursday. And furthermore, let's say, anisotropic and spatially homogeneous for this kind of stuff. So these are all the kind of approximations that we start making in order to get nice theory. Which people like Pat would start joking about. And further, let's assume that there's some scale invariance. And then you want to talk about kind of scaling. And most of the point about turbulence, want to understand scaling. So when I say we want to look at systems at scale invariance, what I mean is that these frequency and this nonlinear interaction coefficient are going to have some scaling properties, which means basically this, that if I would rescale all the wave vectors by some amount, then the frequency scales with some power, and likewise if I take this interaction coefficient W and rescale all of the wave vectors by some scalar H, then the overall thing scales with some other exponent. So I just want to, kind of things I put here are things that I just want to keep because they're kind of notations that are useful. So kind of in particular, you know, this is not a good color. I particularly just want to emphasize, you know, this exponents alpha and beta. Are the scaling exponents of these guys, because everything is going to be in terms of alpha and beta now in a minute. So basically, in terms of scaling, we're going to say that omega k scales like k to the alpha, and this n-wave interaction coefficient in terms of how it scales and counting powers of k is e to n. And, well, these some examples, and I guess the other thing is, you know, k, you know, the actual wave vector is, d. So d is the other parameter that comes in to all of this. So let me write this maybe a little bit more.
Is that a consequence for the Abidal-Chani equation?
Ah, yeah. Well, here, of course, I mean, this, it's clear that this equation is not isotropic.
So we only look at the nonlinearity.
So you should look at, well, but even the frequency is not.
Yeah.
Well, what I would say, you know, forget about forget about Chani Asagaronima at this point, because it's, you know, what I'm saying, the isotropic just makes things a bit easier. Much of what I'll say follows for anisotropic, but much, much harder to kind of write it all down.
If you say scale invariance, does mean you have additional conservation law in the system?
Talk about that, and the answer is I don't know. And you think that there could be, but I don't know what's the conserved quantity association. And it's not that the, I mean, if you think of the thing from a Hamiltonian point of view, I mean, the Hamiltonian itself is not necessarily scale invariant, right? Because the free, in particular, these exponents could be different, right? Different scaling for the linear and nonlinear parts. So it's not that the, you know, in terms of the, if there was a Lagrangian for the theory, it wouldn't have an associated current and so on. So probably not.
Is there a canonical example for such a system?
It depends what you mean by canonical. And one of the curious things about wave turbulence is that every particular example that you might care about has some peculiarity. So there's always something wrong with them. But the one which people, I mean, one example is, for example, capillary waves. And that's basically the dimension is 2 because they're on the surface. The number of waves involved is 3, so it's quadratic nonlinearity, and it's a real quadratic nonlinearity. You can't make it go away. This exponent alpha is 3/2, and this beta is 9/4, I think. So that's one example. Another one is gravity waves. And then again, it's 2-dimensional, n is 4, alpha is 1/2, and beta is 3 in that case. So there's there are various other ones where you can think, but these are actually two kind of, I would say, fairly canonical examples. Okay, so let me just write then for simplicity that omega is some constant times k to the alpha, and omega n, you put g k to the beta times some function of these ratios. And so these guys here, I'm just putting in, these are to make dimensions correct. And this guy, in real problems, I mean, there's maybe some dependence on angles as well. I mean, this is unimportant. You can work it out. All right, so one of the things about this business is that you can actually get quite far just from dimensional analysis in these problems. And actually, it's, in a sense, I mean, all these papers should really start with this, that there's, you know, there is a lot of mathematics which backs up the dimensional arguments, but you can really sort of get almost the entire theory. You know, most of the results of the theory you can get from dimensional arguments, including some of the ones which are kind of not the sort of standard things, you know, but for example, about regimes of replicability and ratios of timescales and so on. So I want to try to show you this right now. I'm going way slower than I thought, but never mind. So let's look at, you know, how far can we get with dimensional analysis. Well, essentially what you want to have, so let me kind of express everything in terms, you know, the one of the ways in which you can get really confused about the dimensional analysis is essentially worrying about whether this energy density here, this E, is a surface energy density or volume energy density, or whether it's, maybe in some systems not even an energy at all. So let me kind of just measure, you know, do the dimensional analysis in such a way that we just measure things in units of this E, whatever it is. And so essentially you'll have dimension, the wave vector over your length minus D, omega obviously is an inverse time, and then A, so this field, this, the normal variable, whatever we've done, you know, just from knowing that, now let me write it first, so that'll be E, G onto the D, And that comes from knowing that essentially EK So I'll just use sort of E as a kind of a dimensional quantity to just keep track of things. And so if you go all kind of through all of this, then you can sort of try to work out, what are the, the dimension of the energy flux in particular, which I'll call J. And dimension of the spectrum turns out to be just energy times time. And the only place really where the nonlinearity comes in to the dimensional analysis is just through this nonlinear interaction coefficient here. So this is where. I'm not going to go through every detail here, but this is all very easy, and you can check later or even now, make sure I haven't made any mistakes. It all seemed to work when I was checking this out in my notes last night. Right. So, actually, the dimensional parameters in the theory then. Is basically trying to repeat what Kolmogorov would have done for vortex turbulence. Well, this parameter, what are the actual dimensional numbers that we can use to build something with? Well, we have a one-dimensional number associated with the frequency, so C. Now that guy, we have this parameter G, which gives the right dimension to the nonlinear interaction coefficient here. So that guy is the one that is a bit messy.
And here you assume that you have Kolmogorov-like turbulence. So flux of energy over the spectrum is constant. Is it correct or not?
No, not yet.
Not yet.
That'll be a conclusion of this.
Sorry?
That will be something a conclusion one will draw, but okay. I'm going to assume that there is. I guess I should have.
You already assumed it in the picture, right? Yes.
Yeah, yeah, okay, so let's say, so in a sense I'm assuming, right, because I'm saying there's a parameter here, J, which is the total energy flux in the system, so, yeah. So you're right, I mean, not necessarily assuming that it's constant as a function of K, but I'm certainly assuming that there is a globally constant in time dissipation range. And that's one of the things, of course, that we want to use to build this. -1. Now, why am I writing out all of this? And then, of course, we want also to include the scale k, which is one inverse length. All right. So, Anza. So let's suppose. So we want to look for a sort of a universal steady spectrum of this. Universal in the sense that I'm not including in this. So these are the building blocks that I'm allowing myself to construct spectrum from. And you'll see that I'm not including here kd or kf. Right, so this is another assumption. So this is an assumption that we want to look for things which are universal, since they do not depend on where the forcing and dissipation are, if they're widely
set. There's a k in brackets, this is l to the minus alpha.
Oh, sorry, this is my d's getting lazy.
But is it, why is it?
That's the product, right?
But isn't every component of K L to the minus 1?
L to the minus, each component is L to the minus, yeah, so that's really rotten. That's really rotten notation then. Yeah. what I mean is that the vector is k-dimensional. So if I'm integrating, I guess the, you know, a dk, the volume element is. Yeah, that's rotten notation. That's for sure. Okay. So we're going to, you know, search for a universal. So that's to say we want n of k to be at least, well, in dimensionally, in dimensional terms, we want, let's see, build from these guys. Now at this point you can already see that this story is different from what we're familiar with from Kolmogorov theory, because essentially there are four unknowns here. And there are three, you know, when we plug this in and equate powers of E, T, and L, you know, we'll get three equations with four unknowns. So just on face value, you can get what, you know, you can make whatever X you want here. And so, and it's sort of clear, right? I mean, there's an additional dimensional parameter in principle in the theory. So, you know, you don't necessarily have a unique dimensional argument. So let me just, again, I'm not going to go through all of the details, but let me just solve this problem, assuming that x is fixed. And this is actually an illuminating thing to do. Just say, well, you know, we have to, if we get rid of this degeneracy by just to say, you know, we're going to fix x and then solve for what these exponents should be, and then at least in dimensional terms, we, so let me just write, you know, if we fix x and solve A, B, and C, so these powers of these guys that we have to put, and this is what we get. Let me get this right. 2 into N. D. So if you happen to have a favorite spectrum for your particular wave system that you really like, then these formulae tell you what combination of the parameters to put so that you predict that scaling. And some, just as an aside, I mean, sometimes it can happen that kind of from physical considerations, there might really be, you know, these quantity, you know, this G and this C might not be independent. You know, for example, if you, in the gravity wave problem, both of them have to be built out of the same G, gravitational acceleration. So it's not always the case that these are two independent knobs that you can turn. But in principle, yeah.
This dimensional analysis is valid for, was that only for quadratic
polynomial? N is everywhere in here. N is the number of waves. So I've kind of really, in some sense, you know, you might, if you, I've tried to solve the most general possible problem here in a very simple way, but all of them are in here. And so if you have particular cases in mind, you can plug things in. But there are now, but why I say this is sort of an illuminating thing to do is because you can now see that there are some special, you know, if you say, well, we're going to go not just, you know, blindly do the dimensional argument, but we're now going to sort of make some more refined statements about certain regimes, one or other parameters may not be relevant, then you can start to see that there are special spectra present just from these arguments. So in particular, suppose we have no dependence on, let me see which one, so this parameter C. Right, so then that means we want A equals 0. Right, so if A is 0, then that means that the exponent of the spectrum has to be 2 beta n over n minus 1 plus d. Right, this is, I guess, here the x, yeah, so x is in the end the scaling exponent of the spectrum. Right? That was a, just forget what we're actually after. Oops. So that's kind of one special scaling that you can get, 2 beta n over n minus 1. So this, well, little n, that's the scaling of the wave interaction coefficient. So this is the Kolmogorov-Sakharov scaling. So it often appears maybe toward, you know, further on in the papers, but actually as the output of a calculation based on wave kinetics. But you can also get it from this dimensional argument. So for example, for three wave processes, the capillary waves, n is 3, so that it's just a beta plus d, which is a kind of a well-known, for those of us in this business, you know, we remember this because it's an easy formula.
A is just a free constant, yeah? A small.
I'm going to do this general dimensional analysis first. So A is, I'm going to determine what A should be.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So dimensionally, if I assume that the spectrum depends on all allowable parameters, except, of course, the forcing and dissipation scales, so the one to universal stuff, then the power of the C, power of the dispersion coefficient that I need to put in is A, and A has to be this if I want to have a spectrum that scales as k to the minus x.
And C is a constant in
the dispersion relation. Right? C is a constant, yeah.
Okay.
And so the point about this is that the dimensional analysis alone doesn't determine the slope of the spectrum, that you have to say a little bit more about what regime you care about. I'm going to care about the regime where I'm not going to include C in the argument. And then what I get is Kolmogorov-Sakharov scaling. Now, the other interesting one is, so that's A1. The other interesting one, too, is no dependence on the flux. So no dependence on J, if I want to do that, that means that C should be 0, the power of J in the thing. And in that case, then, if I want this thing to be equal to 0, then that means that x is twice beta minus alpha over n minus 2 plus d. And this is another spectrum which appears in the literature. It's called, maybe I shouldn't try this.
C equals 0 imply that you don't have the special
relation. Oh, rats, I'm sorry. So I'm using, let me not call this.
C twice, okay.
I shouldn't call it D, E. I shouldn't call E because E is already a universal number. F, there we go. F is the next available one. Sorry. Now, I was wondering, you know, why is Igor getting confused? I know that maybe I'm not being totally clear, but yeah, sorry. If this power f, so f is 0. All right.
Physically, how would we recognize these spectra? Say, no dependent of J, what would be.
So this one appears in the literature as well, right? And it has a physical interpretation. And so it's called, I guess we can't really see down there. So that one is it's called the generalized Phillips spectrum. And so this one, basically, you'll find it. That's what it's called. There's a paper by Newell and Zakharov in 2008 where they write down this spectrum and they give it this name. And the reason is that it is a generalization to arbitrary wave systems. If you would do this, if you would make this assumption that the spectrum does not depend on J for this case, the surface gravity waves, you'd get a spectrum of k to the minus 9 over 2. Which is a very, very old spectrum from the oceanographic literature about the spectrum of surface waves on the ocean under the assumption that the field is dominated by cusps, so that basically the waves have a structure like this, so that there are discontinuities in the derivative. This, of course, for the case of the ocean, this is inspired by the presence of white caps, and so on. But the property, that, I mean, this spectrum, the spectrum that you get by assuming that the wave field is dominated by such cusps is, so it turns out that it, you know, the property that it gets from that is that just from dimensional grounds, it shouldn't depend on J. So if you extend this argument now to kind of any wave system, you get something which generalizes this argument of Phillips about cusps in a sort of roundabout way. And so you get this second spectrum. And what I would argue about this, now there are these, I mean, there is a third one actually, where you assume that nothing depends on G. And actually, I have no idea what that one is. I'm not sure that one has any meaning, actually. Nothing depending on linearity.
But I guess the physical question is, why does the presence of the cusps mean that the magnitude of the energy flux isn't involved?
Well, I would say it's not obvious, but there are reasons why you might think it to be the case. Because it turns out to be the sort of, this cuspy structure has the possibility that it has the property that it can dissipate whatever, you know, if you calculate the total dissipation on such a spectrum, it's kind of free in a sense. So this is the structure that's able to absorb whatever flux flows into it. And I'm kind of getting to the end here, but what I was going to sort of, you know, in terms of the physics of this, I mean, general opinion, and I would say this has not really been shown by calculation, really, by anyone, but the general kind of opinion among most people in the field is that essentially this here, the Kolmogorov-Zakharov spectrum corresponds to the weakly nonlinear cascade process, and the Phillips spectrum, or its generalization, corresponds to a regime of strong wave turbulence.
In what sense weakly nonlinear cascade? Kolmogorov's turbulence is not weakly nonlinear cascade.
No, but in wave case it is. So here, there's basically two competing spectra, right? In the case of Kolmogorov turbulence fluids, there's only one spectrum, so you don't have this discussion. There's 1k to the minus 5/3, it's a strongly turbulent state. Here, there's essentially possibility to construct two possible spectra, and what I would say is that, you know, what's believed to be the case is that this one, the Kolmogorov-Zakharov spectrum, is the one which is realized in over the range of scales where the nonlinearity is weak, and this second one is realized over a range of scales where the nonlinearity is strong, and so it's, in a sense, both spectra are present, you know, both are consistent scalings of the equations, both are consistent scalings in the theory, but the question of, you know, which regime you're in is one which has to be answered kind of on the basis of more careful thinking. But it's not that you can just argue from the outset that the answer is this or this. Both are entirely consistent, at least dimensionally. And indeed, in the ocean, you see, you know, this argument has been raging for many, many years about whether the correct scaling for the surface elevation spectrum in the ocean is a Zakharov spectrum or Phillips one. And depending on your taste, you can find observations which will support either to varying degrees. So it's quite likely that actually both can exist in different regimes.
What do you mean by those can exist in different regimes?
Well, if I had an extra 15 minutes, I'd probably.
Do you mean that there are other parameters with respect to that?
Well, ideally, I mean, what you might have, I mean, a picture that people draw a lot is this one, that you have essentially a crossover scale, and that you have, you know, here, say, at large scales, and this is, so your energy flux is going that way. And here you have this one, Kolmogorov-Zakharov, and here you have a crossover at some point to k to the minus x Phillips. And that essentially dissipation is going on down there. I mean, this is one possibility. I mean, and then, of course, but the question that, so if this is really what's happening, I mean, the rest of the, you know, now we have to ask, well, where are the forcing and dissipation scales relative to this picture? So if dissipation happens here before you get a strong, but, you know, okay. Let's see, how long will it take me to make this? So maybe I'll just spend, I think this question will become clearer if I just do the last little bit here about this argument in terms of separation of time scales. Because what like here it's not clear which would what would be realized where or why I'm saying that this one is weakly nonlinear, that one's strongly nonlinear. But this is entirely unclear. So let me just overrun a little bit and try to make, again, a dimensional argument for the timescale separation, which is what you need if you want to have weakly nonlinear turbulence in this problem.
But in the case of linear turbulence.
Long wave turbulence, yeah.
Linear turbulence, yeah. Turbulence of plasma waves. Do you have the second case? Because
yeah, you have it. I don't know.
Linear waves is a strong turbulence.
Then my guess is that you have this, assuming that that it's a universal spectrum in the first place. Right, if you have some coherent structures which appear and induce the cascade to become non-local, then none of what I'm talking about makes any sense. Right? You know, it's possible that you get entirely out of the regime of having universal spectra in the first place, in particular problems.
Yeah. So is this second spectrum always associated with some formation of some singularities in this eruption? So it's not necessary.
My belief is not necessarily, although at the moment here it's just sort of something, it's a consistent scaling that comes out of dimensional considerations. It's been identified with singularities in the water wave problem. Whether that's always the case, I wouldn't really make a strong statement. Because the curious thing is that Zakharov spectrum, actually, if you would interpret it in terms of singularities, Zakharov spectrum for water waves is actually more singular. It has a worse type of cusp. so even though it's the weakly nonlinear, it's supposed to be the weakly nonlinear regime. So this interpretation about singularities and strong nonlinearity meaning singularities doesn't quite hold up. There's more going on here. But because you know, what can make things a little bit unclear is because you're averaging over things, you can either one strong singularity can give you a particular tail, or many near singularities, when averaged over, can give you a similar tail. So whether you really have, you lose information by going just to the spectrum about structures like this. All right, so let me just try to sketch out this argument about timescale separation, and then I'll stop, because I think that will maybe clarify the end of this here. So essentially, for you know, weakly nonlinear wave turbulence, and I guess I should sort of say that up until now, I haven't actually said anything about weak nonlinearity yet. And this is sort of, you know, in a sense, you know, this is where I kind of disagree with Michael, you know, going back to what Michael McIntyre said about waves and wave turbulence not being a good thing. And in a sense, the it's not the case that this whole theory is just about weakly nonlinear waves. I mean, there's an analog of strong turbulence for waves as well. So weak nonlinearity means essentially that this parameter m is small, and what it means is that the time scale for your, you know, what it means is that the nonlinear term here takes a long time to redistribute energy between different modes in the system, long compared to the typical time of the linear oscillations. So we have two timescales in this regime. There's linear time, which is easy to say what it is. It's just the inverse of the linear frequency. And then there's a nonlinear time. Well, what is the nonlinear time? Well, it's a characteristic time it takes the nonlinearity to redistribute, say, energy in the system. So we could estimate it, say, from this. And we take the wave spectrum and divide by its rate of change, and that'll give us also a time scale, which is, if the nonlinearity is weak, this is going to be very slow compared to that. And so this, you know, weak wave turbulence theory, if you want to sort of derive the wave kinetics consistently from a mathematical point of view, you basically need this ratio to be small. So this ratio is in essence the small parameter that you use to develop the asymptotic expansions, which you'll see in the papers by Newell. And they can be very big, you get many, many terms, and so on, but all of them, you know, there's an epsilon that appears to order this expansion. that epsilon at its root is basically an assumption about separation in timescales, and it ties back to the stuff that Beth Wingate was talking about early on, in where she used exactly the same kind of arguments to separate slow and fast modes in various geophysical problems. So kind of here it's a different application, but exactly the same mathematics. So dimensionally, you know, how do we estimate this guy?
Can you do this in a horses and doggies fashion? So this TL over nonlinear tau, that actually is proportional by M? You're saying that is?
Well, it might be proportional. It might be proportional to M squared. I mean, let's see. The way that I've written here with this, it'll be M squared in the end. Because it'll turn out, I mean, it's not obvious from here. You might think it should be proportional to M, but when you start expanding things out and working out which cumulants are not zero, it turns out you need to go to second order in perturbation theory to get something finite. Just because first order vanishes. I mean, you get, say, here, I mean, if you just had quadratic nonlinearity, your first order will be a cubic term, and the cubic term will be zero just because the field is zero mean. So you need to go actually to next order.
But if you make that argument, you already iterate this linear dispersion, right?
You're probably right, but the point is I don't want to get into all of these calculations, because this is exactly why usually people don't touch this subject, is because once you start really caring about these terms, so what I want to just show is essentially a simple argument for how this thing scales as a function of k, and then stop. So we already can, I guess the point about it is that, maybe before saying anything, is that here, if we're talking about these kind of states where everything is scale invariant, there's some scaling present in the system, then all these timescales are functions of k, and they're going to be power law functions of k. So I can always make a k, either make k, depending on what that power is, I can either make k very big or very small, and I can certainly make that not big, not less than one. And so it's always the case that in these wave turbulence theories, unless you somehow manage to balance things very carefully, you always will be able to find ranges of scales in which the assumption that you have this timescale separation necessary for the kinetic equation, you'll be able to find ranges of scales where that breaks. And so the question always ends up then coming down to, does that timescale where it breaks, where does that lie with respect to your forcing and dissipation scales? Do you have...
So is wave turbulence then... the criterion for wave turbulence to be applicable that M is much less than 1, and the distinction between weak wave turbulence and strong wave turbulence is that...
Weak, up until now, I haven't really said anything about being weak, but now I want to talk about weak wave turbulence. I just want to make an argument to show how can you establish when you would be in the weakly nonlinear regime or not. Because in the weakly nonlinear regime, that's where all this machinery comes in, with kinetic equations, Zakharov transformations, all this mathematics that people do. It's all in the weakly nonlinear regime. But this is what I want to do, is try to show you how you can establish whether you are in that regime or not in the first place. So, all right. Who's chairing this? Go on. Sorry, what about strong?
What about strong nonlinear regime? In that case, how tau L and tau nonlinear?
Well, we'll see.
Well,
in a sense, almost nothing is really known about this regime, but we can say a little. So let's try to we know how the linear time scale is a function of the scale, because it's just that's good. Just k to minus alpha, so that's fine. So we need to just establish this ratio. How does it scale? So we'll calculate scalings. Based on essentially nk scaling like k to the minus x. So I want to say, if I have some particular spectrum, how is this ratio of scales going to behave? So that will, just from the definition of roughly that, from here we can just say that AK is vector scale like k to the minus x plus d over 2. And so now we can start to sort of plug this all in. If we differentiate this delta k and k of I dt, and we get ak dak of I dt. And so we can plug in, I mean, this the only point to note here is that if we're caring about the slow time scale for weakly nonlinear redistribution by nonlinear interactions for dak by dt, we shouldn't estimate that based on the linear term because this doesn't perform any transfer. Right, so we should estimate this guy based on the nonlinear term there. Right, so that's there's an ak, there's an integral of w, there's a to the n minus 1, delta of k, and there's a few dk's to n minus 1. And okay, those delta functions cancel. Plug in this scaling for the a's, and what you'll get at the end is that that thing scales in terms of the wave number as k to the eta. And again, you can check my algebra later. X over 2 plus n over 2 minus 1 times d. Finally, now we can see how our ratio of time scales is behaving. You know, we have kind of an estimate for, you know, that's basically this guy that we need to plug in here. So we can estimate then L. The linear time scale over nonlinear time scale is going to the scale as k minus alpha plus beta minus n minus 2 over 2 minus x minus d. So that's how it goes. So now we can ask, well, okay, if we have, you know, we have some candidate spectra which have come from our purely dimensional arguments, we can just plug these in and see, well, is this ratio becoming big or small? I mean, particularly, say, in the limit. I mean, usually, if you're talking about a direct cascade, you're caring about going to small scales. So let's just look at how this behaves as k goes to infinity. And if it's an inverse cascade, you do the other way. So case one, you put the Kolmogorov-Sakharov spectrum in. So x is beta, limit 2 beta, n minus 1. Plus d, that's the Kolmogorov-Sakharov, and we'll get that tau l over tau. You can, again, you can check this later. You'll find that scales as k to the beta over n minus 1 minus alpha. So nonlinearity, so it becomes weak as k goes to infinity if essentially, this is negative. So beta minus n minus 1 times alpha is less than 0. So for a particular system that you'd be interested in with particular choices for these exponents, you can now check. I mean, if you would you expect to be able to see, would you expect nonlinearity to become weak as you go deeper into the inertial range if the scaling would be Zakharov scaling? And so that's the criterion for it to be true. If it's the opposite case, then essentially the nonlinearity just gets stronger as you go here. And that means that you're basically going to break, you know, whatever nice theory you might do based on assuming this scale separation will become inconsistent. And so final statement, why do I say that the Phillips spectrum corresponds to strong turbulence? So let's put that one in. So that's the other of these two guys. We have two. Beta minus alpha over n minus 2, isn't it? Plus d. Then we find that tau l over tau nl just scales as k to the 0. So the Phillips spectrum is a special one where this ratio of time scales is order 1 at all scales. So this is the link between the strong and the weak. Right? One is the yeah, the Zakharov spectrum, this guy here, you can find it as an exact solution of the kinetic equation. which is derived based on the assumption of this time scale separation. And then here's the criterion for that to be consistent. Now the other guy, the Phillips spectrum, which is the other self-consistent, dimensionally consistent scaling problem, is not an exact solution of the kinetic equation. So it's not expected to be it's not expected to be consistent with the weakly nonlinear theory. But indeed, what you find is that in terms of this separation of timescales on that spectrum, you always have the linear and nonlinear timescales being of comparable order. So hence this kind of picture, right, that you. So if you have, say, a system which is where the weakly nonlinear assumption is consistent at the outset, but as you go downscale it starts to break, then what you expect is that at some point, you know, you can estimate from these formulae what the crossover scale would be. At some point, you'll get into the regime where your timescale separation is order one, and then you'd expect to see a transition to this Phillips spectrum. So that's kind of, I want to stop there because I've way overrun, but I think, you know, if you just take these sort of dimensional arguments and read them first before you get really deep into all of these sort of big 50-page papers, it helps to orient a little bit, you know, what's really going on in the subject and why people are caring about these different things. So, if we can go to questions now.
Any more questions?
Yeah. In principle, you consider Hasegawa mean equation and the follows from Aristotle if you drop dissipated terms. So you always consider Hamiltonian systems. The question is, are there any theory of wave turbulence for non-Hamiltonian systems?
I think that you don't need any Hamiltonian system here. The Hasegawa Mime is a Hamiltonian system, but you don't need this. I mean, it's like the way that I would derive the kinetic equation. And incidentally, I mean,
all Zakharov's formalisms are for Hamiltonian systems.
No, it's valid for Hamiltonian systems and any nonlinear wave equation which is dispersive. The Hamiltonian formalism helps you if you're getting into these subtleties about resonances disappearing and, you know, for example, the removal of the three-wave resonances from the gravity wave problem. This is much easier to see in the Hamiltonian formalism. But if you wouldn't know the Hamiltonian formalism and just plow ahead blindly, you'll still get the right answer because the interaction coefficients for the three-wave will just vanish, and you'll know that you need to go to higher order. But the Hamiltonian formalism, if you have one, allows you to see this much earlier in the calculation, so it's much simpler. But it's absolutely not the case that you need the Hamiltonian formalism as a precursor to doing this kind of wave kinetics theory. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are even examples which Zakharov has done which are dissipative nonlinearity, you know, certainly not Hamiltonian, but he just proceeds from the, you know, with Balk and various people, mm-hmm. just proceeding from the equation of motion. Mm-hmm.
You gave us a gravity wave example, deep water gravity.
Yeah.
So what if you have both shallow and deep, and so you have some crossover?
Yeah, there the story gets a bit murkier again because you have an additional scale, which is the gravity capillary crossover scale. And, well, these arguments about things being scale invariant break. So if that really is the regime you're interested in, then you can, of course, derive a lot of the kinetic theory, but you won't have these scaling solutions because you have a characteristic scale which is sitting right in the middle of the regime that you're interested in, and there's not much you can do about it.
Could you match?
Well, that's what I mean. The people would match. I mean, there's usually be, and this is often in all of these examples where one argues, maybe I've erased now, but I was saying, you know, the particular values for these exponents for particular cases, these are always limiting cases. Where you consider gravity weak or capillarity strong or strong magnetic field or various things. They're always limiting.
I'm still hanging a little bit with the two types of spectra.
Yeah.
Let's presume we take the majestic algebra and we carefully initialize it in a way that it would carry a Phillips spectrum by arranging the base spectrum in a way that the nonlinear interaction term and the linear interaction term would be constant.
Mm-hmm.
The theory does not say anything about the stability of that spectrum.
Well, the theory does. It's just I didn't say. I mean, this was also, I mean, there's a huge volume of literature about stability of all of these things as well.
Would it be stable, or would one expect that?
Well, in the case
it appears and it relaxes to the well, let's say more.
In the case of the Phillips spectrum, I honestly think nobody knows. And you know, this, I'm telling this story with far more confidence than it actually merits, because nobody has really even convincingly observed this kind of crossover between the weak to, you know, this. No one has really seen this Phillips coexisting with the. So this is theoretically plausible, but numerically, I mean, I think, in my opinion, this is one of the things which people in wave turbulence field need to sort out. You know, is this really the truth or not? With numerics, you know, some controlled numerical experiment. It's not so easy. In the case of CHM equation, I honestly don't know. I mean, I suspect that if you would start, I mean, there the question, it's kind of complicated by all kinds of things, like it's anisotropic. There's a second conservation law, which I've brushed away. So there are actually two cascades which can go to each other.
But set this up, see that it's numerically very nice for some time, and then it doesn't sort of face transition.
I don't know is the answer there.
But usually if you have two slopes.
By the way, I think, you know, people who have things, you know, we may discuss for a while, so people who want to leave don't feel they should stay. <Yeah.
laughs> But usually if you have two spectra, different spectra, implies that you have two independent conserved quantities.
These spectra are both in the case of. So the way to think about it is, you know, the example which I find illuminating, and maybe that's just because I think weirdly, is in if you look at if you type kinetic theory into Google, 99% of the results which will crop up are not about waves, but they're actually about chemical kinetics. And so in chemical kinetics, it's very well known that there, in a particular system, there is essentially, you know, the linear term is diffusion and the nonlinear term is reaction. And there are two scalings that come about in many, many of these systems based on whether the system is diffusion limited or reaction limited. And so you can, and this is, in my picture, rather analogous, that there's a sort of there's a regime in which the system is limited by the nonlinearity, and there's a regime in which it's limited by dispersion. And this, so I think that there's a parallel there. It's not that you have a second conserved quantity responsible for the different scaling in, say, diffusion limited regime versus reaction limited regime of chemical kinetics. It's just that you have different physical setup. Different time scales are important. So here there's a similar competition between a linear time scale and a nonlinear time scale, and one can be long with respect to the other, and depending on which one is long, which one, you get different scalings.
It's actually what happens in a Michi turbulence. So you can start from weaker Michi turbulence, which will be wave dominated, linearity will be weak, and you get one spectrum, exactly as it's shown here. Then as you go to very large wave numbers, to small scales, the spectrum changes to strong Michi turbulence. In this condition, this Phillips spectrum is actually exactly a critical balance of Goldratt's victory. Mm-hmm. Precisely when those two scales are on the same order everywhere. Okay.
Yeah, actually, that's something which I should say. Actually, if you know this, I mean, this generalized Phillips spectrum that Newell and Zakharov call generalized Phillips is exactly what Nazarenko and Shekhochikhin and so on call critical balance spectrum. Yeah. It's exactly the same. Yeah. You know, they arrived at it by arguing exactly that this ratio of scales should be this ratio of time scales should be independent of the spatial scale. Yeah,
this is
and that's how they get
this
critical balance.
This is Goldratt and Schreeder.
Goldratt and Schreeder have as well.
Who proposed it?
Yeah.
Let's thank Colin again.